Welcome to the world's best social work show. I'm Ernesto from Social Work Mentor. You can find all my details in the description of this recording. But I wanted to welcome you and thank you for joining us this week. This is our second week, as I mentioned, of the World's Best Social Work Show. We had a different cast of co-hosts than what we had during week one, which you can also find in the recordings here on this channel. But this week we had a couple of the same people and a couple of new people. And so we're going to hear varying perspectives on a few different topics. The topics this week were Don't Say Gay, which is related to a bill that was passed recently in the state of Florida. However, the discussion goes more into kind of advocacy and the role of social workers as advocates. We talk about sleepovers and whether or not those are a good idea for children, and how we as social workers, therapists, counselors, how we're impacted by the work that we do when we do become or when we are parents. And finally, we talk about the slap, like many people have done in recent weeks, but we talk about it from a social work perspective, and we really get into kind of the topics of stress, the impact of high stress times, particularly in today's day and age with the pandemic and the economy and everything that's going on. So a lot of very different topics and very different perspectives. And so I hope you enjoy this episode 2 of the World's Best Social Work Show. So let's get into it. Hey everybody, what's up? Welcome back to the world's best social work show. I'm a little flustered because we've had some technical difficulties, so if you're seeing this live, you found us back here again. But if you were watching the recorded version of this, just know that pretend like all that other past 5 minutes just didn't happen right now, and we're going to start as we go right now. And so as you can see, this week we are starting with three other social work professionals and myself, and we have hopefully two others on the way that you saw last week. And we have a couple of good topics that we're going to go with tonight, so, or this morning or this afternoon, wherever you may be. But before we do that, I want to, since we do have a new person joining us, and in case you didn't see it last week, I wanted to let us all introduce ourselves. So I'll go ahead and start. My name is Ernesto. You might have seen me on TikTok or Facebook or other places as Social Work Mentor. And I am on the West Coast of the United States. And this is a show that we've put together to try to bring some awesome, very different, diverse professionals in for discussion on social work related topics, therapeutic topics, or just stuff from pop culture from kind of like a social work lens. So that's what we're going to do in this show. And with that being said, I will pass it on, I guess, as I see you on my screen here, Sabrina. You can go next while I try to do some other thing over here. So don't mind my looking over here. Sabrina.
No worries, Ernesto. I got it. Hi, everybody. I'm Sabrina. You can find me on TikTok or Instagram at Sabrina in Social Work. I focus on macro social works, which is social services administration, and also public policy. So thanks for joining.
All right. And next up, as I see you, is Destry.
Hey, everybody. My name's Destry. You can find me on TikTok at Destrio. I am in the child protection field, so I do a lot of direct client work and investigations. And then aside from that, I also am trained in trauma-focused cognitive behavioral therapy and then work with youth who have been abused or neglected and have trauma symptoms from that.
All right. Awesome. And now, lastly for now, until we get our other people joining us, we have Brittany.
Can you hear me?
Can you hear me now?
People froze, and then I was like, oh, snap. Okay, what's up? My name is Brittany Williams. You can find me on all of my socials as B Williams LCSW. I'm a licensed clinical social worker. I am a social worker and psychotherapist that owns my own group practice. So we provide individual, couples, family, groups, primarily specializing in working with individuals with complex trauma, generational trauma, et cetera, add to it. I'm also an adjunct professor, and I teach intro to social work courses at a local community college, and I'm out here in the West Coast, San Diego.
All right, cool. Well, thank you, everyone, and we may have some other introductions as we go along on this show. Hopefully, our friends will pop up for us here, but if not, we're going to go ahead and continue. So one of the topics that we were actually going to cover tonight, we hopefully will still cover it, but the person that was going to kind of take that on is not here yet. So we will go ahead and start with the item number two for the my fellow co-host here. We'll go with that one. And so the topic that we're going to talk about here, roughly titled, is social workers as parents. I don't know. I'm comfortable sharing that I am a parent of two teenage, well, actually one adult and one almost adult daughters now. So I've gone through 18 years or so of being a parent as a social worker. And I'm not sure if others on here, well, I know if they're parents or not, but I'm not sure if they want to share. They can in the course of their talking. But what we're going to kind of discuss is there was a topic that one of our co-hosts had brought up. They had posted on TikTok a video about sleepovers and kind of some of the risks that that may exist when children or youth minors go on sleepovers with friends or even family. And there was a lot of kind of feedback from community members and other professionals just about that topic. And so one of the things that you know, that may be a part of the question that we'll tackle tonight is, are we as social workers, or can we be, hypersensitive to some of the things out there that possibly could occur just because of what we witness and the work that we do? We see so much. Or are we very actually realistic and pragmatic about those risks and appropriately protective of our own children? So I won't share my experience yet as a parent regarding this topic, because I want to open it up now for someone else. So do any of you want to go ahead and get us started on this, parent or not?
I can definitely go, because I am very familiar with the video that you're speaking of, and I hopped on it right away to comment when I saw it on TikTok. So I like to think that it's a healthy balance between like being a parent, being protective, knowing the risk factors, but also like the work can jade, you know, get you jaded in some ways. But again, I don't necessarily think that's always a bad thing when you're looking at the reality and the risk associated with it. So I do have two little kids. My son is kind of at that age where sleepovers are starting to become a thing. And I say, no, it's not going to happen. If he wants to have friends over, he can, you know, I'd be okay if they want to have sleepovers at my house. Again, I think that's maybe more like that selfish parent view of mine, not necessarily social work. So obviously, if another parent would be comfortable with that, then that would be up to them. But I just have seen so much in doing a lot of problematic sexualized behavior, child protection cases between young kids. So not even just like the adults in that home, but seeing things that have happened between youth who are exploratory and that can lead to really unhealthy behaviors. And it's not in the setting, obviously, that I would want my child to learn about their sexuality. And so I am very firm that I, as of right now, at this stage in my life and where my kids are at, I'm not going to be doing sleepovers. And a lot of that's my child protection background, but also I think it's the education and just knowing what I want for my kids and my values and the risks. And the fact that social media is so big that kind of anything and everything's pretty accessible. I just want to be in control of what my children are learning and making sure that it's in a healthy, open environment where there's no pressure or learning the wrong types of things about sexuality. So that's my thoughts anyway.
And how do your kids respond to that? Are they okay with it? Do they understand it? Do they get mad?
You know, I think my son understands it. We have a lot of conversations in our house. I have always viewed that as like, we're going to be an open household. We're going to talk about sexual education at appropriate developmental levels, of course. So we talk very freely about, here's why mom doesn't want you to have sleepovers, because here's the risks. You know, I'm not trying to scare him, and I don't like share overboard about that. But just helping him know boundaries and, you know, that I want him to always be safe. And so I kind of frame it around that I don't think that everybody's bad and that you're, you know, if you go to sleepover, right, you're automatically going to get hurt. Because I don't want him to be fearful of the world either. But just right now, while you're little, it's mom's job to make sure you're safe. And so this is just what we're going to do for right now. So he does have a few like family members that I trust and have very good relationships and know that there's good supervision. And so there's a few family members where he can go spend the night there. But again, we have limitations around that too.
Right. All right. Well, anybody else have thoughts on this topic? And as you see, I continue to have some stuff going on over here. So hopefully it doesn't distract. What about, Brittany, I thought I saw you might have had something to contribute here.
Yeah, I got a group of kids. my kids are all 7 years apart too. So I feel like I'm parenting in all stages from 2, 9 and 16 going on 17. You know, I will. So here's the thing. I'm a social worker, but I've never worked county where I've never worked in child welfare. Right. So I want to be clear that I probably have not seen what y'all have seen and have been exposed, like, you know, to the level of work and whatnot as you. But one of the things I'll speak more so from a cultural standpoint. One of the things that I've learned and I feel like I am more sensitive to is, in therapy, working with folks who come from the Black and Brown community, I've realized that we don't talk enough to our kids. Like, so having open dialogue is something that I'm really, really probably sensitive to and learning, because I know I'm a therapist and I'm supposed to know how to do that. But as a parent, it's very hard. It's a new thing. And so I'm learning to have open, vulnerable conversations without judgment, right? Without protection, being protective of my kids, and just, you know, talking about, you know, what, you know, what they're exploring in whatever season they are, in school and with friend groups, normalized, you know, social norms, etc. So, you know, one of the things that being a therapist in my practice has taught me is when there has been a violation of someone's boundaries in any way, especially culturally, we just don't talk about it. Like, you'll see one parent that just protect, you know, make sure this shit stops. And then we're going to, like, you know, not talk about it anymore. And that kid is left to cope and soothe, you know, and then deal with the repercussions of that. So I think that we don't talk enough about it, you know, within certain cultures and communities. And so I think that that's something that I try to be intentional about with my kids. Not perfect. My kids will totally put me on blast and tell you that I'm not, but it's something that I'm learning to do as a parent. So, yeah.
Yeah. I think that's a super important kind of perspective to layer on this, is the cultural lens that definitely plays a part in, you know, this particular topic. Sabrina, did you have a perspective on this?
Yeah, I am. I'm not parenting. So I just have a gaggle of nieces and godchildren that I collect. I always say I just collect all the little godchildren, and it's great. but I did do, I was a nanny. I was a full-time nanny. I did childcare for 15 years. And so lots of experience, as well as doing my first internship, my first MSW internship in CPS. My mom has also worked in Child Protective Services for 20 years, kind of throughout the entire system. And so I do feel like it heightens the knowledge that we have of what can potentially happen. And I think the thing that I really get stuck on, and again, I'm not parenting currently, but I think about often, is what we know is that it is typically the trusted person. It's very commonly family members, and there's definitely cultural implications with that. And so I'm always, you know, even hesitant to say, well, you can't go to the friends because I don't know them. Because I'm like, quite frankly, everyone's potential predator. And like, it's a terrible, like, I know that that's a terrible lens, but it's also the reality. Like, statistically speaking, if we're going to look at numbers, that's what it's going to happen. And that's a great point about children exploring and having those experiences at really young ages. And it's something that we don't even have kind of the research. We don't really look at what the traumatic impact of that is on children. And so I think that that's a place that could probably use more attention. But I love how you talked about, like, let's talk about it. Let's have those conversations, because then they have the words for it. They can name experiences much more easily than if you never have the conversation, you don't talk about it. They don't have names and labels. They don't know what that feeling is. They don't, you know, having the ability to then communicate those things is so, so important. So I just absolutely love that. And, I think that's probably like the kind of the only thing you could do to like work towards having your children be as safe as you can make them.
Yeah. Yeah. Those are also great points. I think. Well, for me, I'll speak obviously as the, you know, I'm a father here. So I think I'm the only father on this panel. Don't want to make any assumptions, but I believe that to be true. And I am the father of two daughters, as I mentioned. So it really, you know, now that one is 18, going on 19 in a few weeks, and the other one 16, going on 17. So like I said, it's their whole lives has been kind of a, as a male social worker, you know, I've seen things and I know things. And I think it's being a social worker as a parent to me has kind of been a blessing and a curse, because it's been a blessing in some ways, because in my career, I've had the opportunity to, you know, be a certified parenting class facilitator and do, you know, run domestic violence groups and support groups and all the stuff that we, a lot of us typically do. And so in that work, you know, you, not only do you teach those concepts, you actually can learn and internalize them, which I, you know, hopefully did to the best of my ability. So those ideas and concepts and frameworks for parenting, I was able to use them as a parent of my daughters, and it was easier in that way to approach some of these topics, and so that's kind of the blessing. But the curse is, again, knowing and being exposed to what is possible out there, what could happen. And so I think for me as a father, similar to what some people have already said, we have always had a very open conversational kind of relationship. And, you know, I always try to tell my daughters the realities of things at their appropriate level. And I remember having to have those very early on, those difficult kinds of teaching moments about, you know, what's okay, what's not okay. And, you know, that it kind of, I mean, it sounds kind of crazy, but I remember saying that, you know, anybody who makes you feel uncomfortable or not okay, then you need to tell me. And that could be someone that you know, you don't know, or someone that you know. And the part that sounds kind of crazy is I think I remember even adding in even myself, like, because I couldn't guarantee, we never know what we, you know, mental health issues or what things could happen. I get chills just thinking about that possibility right now. But I even approached it in that way. No matter who it is, if you're uncomfortable, you need to let me or mom know. And obviously my wife also had conversations from a mother's perspective with them that were probably much more effective in many ways. But, just that, having to have those conversations, again, you're empowered many times as a social worker because you maybe have the skills to approach it in a effective way. But at the same time, because of what you know, it's kind of difficult. And like I said, for me as a dad, I even had to kind of put myself in the place of a potential person that, you know, that if it ever came to it, they would need to also tell someone that I was making them feel uncomfortable, because it wasn't about me. It was about their experience and what made them comfortable or not. So, I mean, that was 18 years ago now, and I don't remember all the details of it, but I do remember the uncomfortability of like that kind of area between how do I tell them about these risks and still make them feel safe and okay just in the world. So I'm going to take a deep breath after that one. That was a little, anything else to add before I think
I was just going to, there's this one article from, I think it was like 2013 on the Good Men Project website. Hey Heather. And it was called, Teaching Consent 1 to 21. And it's a fantastic article. If anybody, you know, just is interested in that. There's a couple of things now where you're like, okay, well, we've moved a little bit past that because it, you know, it's almost 10 years old. But I even just kind of went back to it this week when someone was talking about teaching consent. And just looking at it and having a conversation, I remember I was in group with a bunch of mothers who were between 18 and 30. And we went through this teaching consent. You know, it's just like, here's what you do for little kids. Here's what you do for this age group. And one of the moms I was working with, like, had a very vulnerable moment and was like, I think this is the reason that I experienced sexual abuse as a child from family members, was because she was taught kind of all of the opposite things of consent, right? You're a child, your feelings don't matter. You're not going to be listened to. You have to go sit on this person's lap. You have to go on a drive with this person. This person's going to give you a bath, and just kind of all of those experiences. And her children really had terrible physical boundaries. The minute that they like walked into our program, they came and ran up to us with like big hugs. And my coworker, my other case manager, was like, you know, a 6'2", 400 pound man who was like, whoa, you know, and was like, self hugs. And then we were like, okay, we're all going to hug ourselves today. And so it was like immediately clear that this had never been a conversation for these kids, that they were kind of taught the opposite, that like you were going to, like they were going to fawn. That was going to be their survival tactic. And their stress response was, mm-hmm. you know, jumping into the arms of all these people who like, they literally didn't know us. But it was so amazing to watch this mom have this moment of, I can do something for my children. I wasn't protected in that way, but I can do that for my children. And I can institute these things with my family members, with my children. I can make choices about who my kids see, like who wasn't safe for me, and why do I still let them around my children? You know, she was able to like have those realizations, and it was just like a really beautiful moment that we don't always give people the skills or the words to have. And like you were saying, there's a big cultural piece to it too, that, you know, it's really inappropriate in a lot of, you know, in a lot of families to shun out one family member because of their inappropriate behavior. But giving this mom that power back to be able to name it, say, this isn't going to be okay with my kids. And it wasn't okay when it happened to me. It was just like a really powerful moment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you for that, Sabrina. That's also, you know, it's funny that the experience that you brought up about the big dude and kind of, whoa, being the, I can definitely relate to that. And it's a, you know, it's a strange, it's interesting how all of us as social workers, just what we bring to the field, what we bring to our particular roles is so different. And how we interact with people is, you know, you can get a social worker, but depending on which social worker you're working with or which therapist, you know, things can be so different just based on our own experiences. And so, but before I go start talking too much more, I wanted to, our fellow co-host here was able to show up. We're glad for that. So we have Heather. So Heather, we'll give you a second to introduce yourself, but also we kind of took things out of order. So we're talking now about the sleepover topic. And I didn't say who it was because I wasn't sure if they were going to make it tonight, but Heather was actually the one who had posted a TikTok video about this topic. So Heather, if you want to introduce yourself and if you want to say anything on this topic. And meanwhile, I'm going to try to set something up for the next topic. So I'll be clicking away here.
Sure. Sorry, I'm late, everyone. My name is Heather, and I'm a former CPS social worker, and I'm currently working on my MSW. And I did a TikTok that went viral about my experiences as a CPS social worker and why sleepovers are not a good idea. I feel like there's so many avenues that, like, you know, could spawn off of that one TikTok based on the feedback that I got. But I think the thing that is important to think about, and I acknowledge, like, yes, you know, we all have biases, but I think informed of what's going on is a whole nother thing. But one of the things that keeps coming up is, well, I don't want my child to lose out on social opportunities. And so I keep thinking, like, what do they gain from sleeping in a different place that they can't gain through other social opportunities, and minimize the risk? And I think that if we have, like, a candid conversation about that, I think that people would probably understand the perspective a little bit more. But I do think that my experiences as a CPS social worker definitely colors, like, how I make decisions as a parent. And, you know, once you are aware of things, it's hard to become unaware. And you see the world in a very different perspective and different, you know, manner than regular people do. That's kind of what I would like to say about that topic. I think that, you know, it's a very polarizing topic, as I found out. but everyone's entitled to their own opinion. I really came from, like, a child safety perspective. And if we can minimize risk to our children, why wouldn't we? But again, I respect everybody's, you know, personal decision. And I'm hopeful that if they do allow them, that nothing negative happens to their children.
Yeah. And just one other thing. Were you going to say something, Brittany?
Go ahead. I just kind of want to bring this into the conversation, because as I'm listening, I'm just kind of reflecting on my own experiences as a former single mom. Is I don't know if all parents have the privilege to pick whether their kids are going to spend the night or not based off of childcare. Based off of, you know, working overnight shifts and whatnot. So I think that that's something important to think about. Sure, if it's within our control, right? But that there are, you know, every parent's experience is different, and access to, you know, childcare is different as well. And so I think that, I don't know, I was kind of just reflecting on that as well.
That's a great point.
I was actually, it's funny, I was thinking very similarly. Like, when I was little, I had a single mom, and one of my best friends, I, like, lived at her house half the time, but most of it was because of childcare issues. And my mom would be working until, like, 1 a.m. So she'd rather I be at my best friend's house than alone with my brothers, who, you know, were a whole 6 years older than me. And it's interesting you just said that, Brittany, because I was just thinking, like, I don't know what my mom would have done if I couldn't stay at Kristen's house, you know? And so, and I think that does also speak to, like, who are those trusted people and what does that look like? And that, you know, you might have a pretty narrow group, you know, 2 or 3 people who you are going to have that relationship with and be able to trust that way. You're not going to just drop them off at any house. But in some cases, like that is definitely some of the things that my mom's that I worked with dealt with, where they found a babysitter and it was someone who they can afford. And it was the only overnight person who could care for their kid. And, you know, it's an unfortunate risk that they had to take in those moments, that they had to weigh, and they knew that. But yeah, that's, there's definitely a piece there.
And I will say, as a social worker that's been in that type of situation where I've had to have babysitters come in, I am hypersensitive because I'm calling every 30 minutes. I'm like, why aren't you answering the phone? Like, you know,
you don't have cameras in every corner.
I actually did have cameras when my son was born, because I had, so school start at 9 o'clock out here. Well, your girl goes into work at 7:38, right? And that's not accounting traffic. So, you know, I had to get someone to take her to school and then to watch my son for a certain amount of hours. So I did have cameras, and I did tell the, you know, the babysitter, like, hey, just so that you know, like, are you comfortable? Like, we're not recording, but, you know, it just allows us to keep an eye on the house. They're like, yeah, we're fine with it. And so I think because I'm a social worker, I was definitely tapping in a lot more than probably your average parent. But
you kept your kids safe, though, bottom line.
Yeah.
You know, another piece that I want to bring into this too, just when you're talking about the privilege of having someone, you know, or, you know, sleepovers even being an option, is that when my daughters were growing up, you know, my wife and I have family, we have friends, but really oftentimes it just wasn't, because we lived kind of far or timing, it wasn't, I mean, quite frequently, it wasn't realistic to even ask those who we trusted to be able to take care of our kids. And that kind of takes a toll on a relationship, because on an adult relationship, because if you know, if it's hard for you to find the time to kind of have some separation from your kids because of issues of availability of childcare or trust or whatever it may be, then that over time that drags on a relationship and it makes things difficult, because your whole life is about your raising of your children, which is not a bad thing, obviously, but there needs to be balance. And so that kind of, you know, makes it hard. So one of the semi little patches that I was able to come up with when my daughters wanted to go to sleepovers is, and I know this wasn't 100% foolproof, but it allowed for me to let them have that social kind of time with their friends and me to feel comfortable with it. So I would let them go sometimes. And obviously we had to know the families and, you know, be comfortable with that. And they could go, you know, for the evening, watch movies, eat popcorn, do whatever, when everyone's there, the group. But then when it came time to kind of wind things down and everybody was going to be going to sleep, I would go, or my wife would go, or we would go and pick them up at that time, and even take them back in the morning when everyone kind of woke up and they were, you know, going through that. So it was, again, it's more of a drain. I mean, we did as a couple get some hours at least out of that, but it was also a drain. Like, we got to go pick them up and drop them off, and it becomes this bigger thing. But that was kind of the balance that I tried to find, and don't know if it was foolproof, or I think it was kind of foolproof based on where we are now, but it may not work for everyone. But that was just, you know, you have to get creative sometimes, I guess, is my bottom line. So that, I think that was a very good topic. Here we go. So I think we can at this point move on. Thank you everyone for your awesome conversation on that. So we can move on now to our next topic. So it's kind of a little bit dated at this point, but in one respect, in terms of like the specific legislation that we're going to talk about, but as an overall topic, it's not dated. It's not going away. So some people who are watching this, you may have heard of, or you may be familiar with some legislation in Florida that has come to be known as the Don't Say Gay Bill. And so, you know, obviously as social workers and following our NESW code of ethics, you know, we have the obligation to advocate and, you know, to speak up for and represent the needs of those, you know, different classes of people who need that kind of advocacy. So I'm going to first see if I can share just a little. I tried to find a kind of neutral video that just talks, you know, not really from one side or the other about this topic, and then we'll discuss it. So let me see if I can. And also, Heather, you missed out on the fun. You know how we had a little issue last week? It was like 5 times worse, if not more, this week.
But oh, darn it.
We made it through. So let me see. Let me see if I can get it here. Are you able to see that? No? Oh, hold on. I need to bring it in. Now you can see it, right? Okay.
Yep.
All right. So, and I hope you'll be able to hear it. If not, stop me, but I'm going to push play and then we'll have a discussion after this.
Lock the board and record the vote.
22 yeas, 17 nays.
You hear it?
So the bill passes.
Okay. Yep.
George Stephanopoulos here. Thanks for checking out the ABC News YouTube channel. If you'd like to get more videos, show highlights, and watch.
All right. Are we back? Are we back? Everyone can hear and see? Okay, good. All right. So that is hopefully kind of sets us up for the topic and for the discussion. And so I don't know. I guess maybe Heather, if you feel comfortable, you want to take this one over and
sure.
We'll go with this topic.
Yeah. So prior to watching the video, Ernesto kind of touched on the National Association of Social Workers Code of Ethics. And prior to that video, I had read an article that did a study amongst social workers in Tennessee to see what their level of understanding regarding the LGBT community and their attitudes and beliefs towards that, you know, population of folks. And it was pretty, I don't even know, pretty alarming, I guess, what they found. And ultimately, it comes down to the Council on Social Work Education is responsible to prepare all of these social workers to be culturally competent or working towards cultural competence, working with the LGBTQ population. And so basically what this article found, and I'm curious to see what you all think about this, but they found that social workers that believe sexual orientation is biologically determined have more favorable attitudes towards sexual minorities and are significantly more supportive of the great gay rights initiatives. And that sexual orientation comes to be largely viewed as a result of genetics, and there may be greater support for gay and lesbian civil rights and a reduction in stigma associated with those sexual minorities. However, they found like a vast majority of these social workers that had been in the field from anywhere from like 2 years to 30 years felt ill-prepared to work with the population, and they had a lot of negative attitudes towards this population. So I think it's important as social workers to talk about these bills and how we can, you know, support and advocate for these individuals, because there are many states, not just Florida. Tennessee has a Don't Say Gay bill. I think maybe Oklahoma has one.
There's Alabama. Several states.
Alabama. Yeah, so there's several states right now. And recently, Texas just had the governor, you know, try to enforce mandated reporters to report for child abuse parents that were supporting their children in transitioning. So there's a lot of these laws that are or legislation that's being trying to be passed into law. So I guess as social workers, where do we start? Like, how do we work on becoming more proactive with our advocacy, and how do we improve our education for social workers to be prepared and working towards that cultural competency?
I think so much of it really starts at just that reflection. Like, what do I know about this population? Where's my comfort level in working with this population, or maybe addressing topics regarding that population with people who don't understand or aren't in support? I think that's really where the work starts, because if you don't know how you feel about it or where your knowledge level is, you're not going to know where to go next. There's lots of resources out there. Like, I have just done quite a few trainings regarding this population and how to implement TFCBT with, a twist on how to adapt it so you are meeting the needs of youth who are really coming to terms with their gender identity and who they are, and how does that impact their trauma, and how do they, you know, view it through that lens. But there's just so many things. Like, first you got to figure out where you stand, and then you need to start looking for resources and get a diverse understanding, a lot of different resources, read up on different points of view. I think it's helpful as well. But yeah, I mean, I feel like I don't know how else you get better unless you start having those conversations with yourself and with your coworkers and holding others accountable as well.
I feel like a lot of this comes out of cost, though. Here's what I mean by that. A lot of social workers don't go into the field and just work with other social workers, right? Our directors could be PsyDs, LMFTs, and we all don't have the same, you know, code of ethics. So I've worked in settings with like some pretty racist clients, and who have been, you know, making comments to me and then to, you know, my team members. And it's like, or even systemically, right? Like working in schools and seeing stuff happen there that's out of pocket and oppressive. It's like, how do you advocate when you're in a system, you're working in a system that you need to pay your bills, and you're pushing, if you push the line, that can come, that's what I mean, that it could come at a cost. So I feel like if we move, we got to move together, but how do we move together when social workers are alone?
I think one big part of this that like I always like to remind folks is that, and this kind of goes back to another thing I saw the last week about, you know, the time it takes to do advocacy, is that we don't always have to just advocate during our 9-to-5. It's really great when our 9-to-5 allows us time to advocate. And that's like a really privileged position to be in. And I recognize that. But I think that there are things that we can do on our own as social workers to advance further legislation or even just kind of like local councils and counties. But I agree that like we can't do it alone in our organizations and institutions. And so how do we as social workers then prioritize it for our institution when they're really uncomfortable with it? And that has been, that's been the thing, right?
Yeah. So in teaching, even though I teach at a community college, I don't even teach at a grad school level. One of the things that I integrate into my curriculum is how to advocate to someone above you, right? How to put it in writing, speak to your code of ethics to cover yourself. Because we've seen, we've seen it go wrong plenty of times. And so I think that's one of the things that I try to do is like learning from, like seeing stuff like this is wild, but then how do we make moves, especially when we're within organizations that can be oppressive. So that's one of the things that I do is like, we do like mock scenarios. Like how do you advocate? How do you practice assertiveness? Because a lot of, specifically for, for me, has being a Chicana, I was kind of raised to be submissive to authority. And so I had to find my voice, right? So there's a cultural piece to that. So really practicing and I think teaching social workers how to speak up, how to advocate within their positions and then outside is, I think, super key.
Mm-hmm. I think I'll bring maybe a little different slant on this discussion. And it kind of ties into what you were saying, Sabrina, about advocating and doing the work outside of our 9-to-5. And so for the past 4 years or so, I've had the privilege of serving as an elected official at a local school board here where I live. And so it's really interesting in that role how, you kind of certainly, definitely 1,000%, I try to bring, and I think people doing this kind of work should bring their social work lens to the job, to the work, because I think that so many skills that we have, so much of what we do is an integral part at the policy level, whether it's local school boards or all the way up to national. I think we bring a unique perspective that is missing and I think vitally needed. And for me, one of those perspectives as a school board member is kind of like looking holistically or looking at the big picture, trying to take in all of the information and then kind of piece together the story and address it, maybe piece by piece as the situation dictates. And so I had a super busy week. I didn't have time to go super deep into the law and the legislation that we're talking about. But from what I read, there's in the bill itself, there's no mention to specifically about, LGBTQ, like saying gay or anything. That's kind of like the name that it was given. The bill, as I understand it, at least from what I was able to gather, is more speaking to like talking about sexuality from kindergarten to third grade, I believe, in any form. Just kind of, not covering the topic in those ages at all, unless it's brought up by a child and then a teacher is able to talk about it. So as a social worker / policymaker at a local level, I know that I do have parents who, want me to advocate and do that side of the work. But I also have parents who are more on the conservative end of things and not necessarily like super conservative, but just, I guess I would say traditional, like they're not comfortable for their children at a young age to just hear that topic at all. And this is, not this specifically, but similar kind of topics have come up for us. And so, as a social worker, I think that I'm able to kind of hear those two things. It's like, if you're working with a family and maybe you hear, you know, a mom and a dad give their two perspectives, or a mom, dad, and a child. And then you kind of synthesize all that information and try to put something out that's most effective, or that has the best impact on all of the parties involved. And so I guess what I'm trying to say here is that as social workers, you know, 1,000% when we see disadvantaged communities or these protected classes, whatever they may be, whether they're ethnic or disability or you know, gender, sexuality, whatever it may be, we have the obligation to do that work. But at the same time, I think we also have the skills and the ability to bring a nuanced, balanced approach when needed. That if nothing else, I think sometimes in my experience, at least at this school board level thing, if people can see that you are being fair, if you're looking at all sides and then coming to, whether it's an advocacy position or whatever, they tend to respect more that you're not just, you know, coming at this because of your own thoughts or biases or opinions, but that you've really put, you know, some thought into it, and that's what you're sharing with people. So I think that was kind of what I took from this is that kind of perspective.
From my, so I think the one line that is really the one that's detrimental and also ends up being ridiculous in a way that a lot of teachers are kind of making a fool of this bill, is that in essentially like this preamble piece of it, in the beginning part, it says, prohibiting classroom discussion about sexual orientation or gender identity in certain grade levels or in a specified manner. Mm-hmm. So when you're talking about sexual orientation and gender identity, heterosexuality is an orientation. Yes. Being a female is a gender identity. So that's where, that's the language that's problematic, is that they don't know, like, then it looks like you just don't know what you're talking about when you're the lawmaker who's writing this. Mm. But and how do you say no gender identity conversation, right? Like,
well, Sabrina, I'm wondering if you have seen the TikTok that provides like a template for teachers that kind of like, from here on out, there will be no reference to male, female, Miss or Mrs. I'll be MX from now on. Like, and it kind of like lays it all out of like, okay, if this actually passes, this is what the outcome will be. Like, I will remove all literature in my classroom and reference to, you know, gender terms,
heterosexual couples.
Yeah.
It's just like so poorly written in that part that they tried to use it as a gotcha on their side. And now the other side is like, haha, this is actually the gotcha, is that you did not specify. Correct. So now we cannot talk about anybody's gender identity. We cannot talk about anybody's sexual orientation. Yeah. And that would include any type of heterosexuality or gender in general. The other thing that I think is really interesting that I haven't heard any social workers talk about, and this might be a conversation for another one, the most of the bill is actually focused on the school being required to report any changes or concerns to the like physical, mental, or social well-being or something like that. And the only caveat it has to it, or the caveat it has to it, not only, but the caveat of this is if the kid is going to be put at danger of like physical abuse, neglect, or abandonment, then the school can use that as an out. But I just thought that was interesting that like, we're not having that bigger conversation. Again, I don't do direct practice, so I don't really know what the laws in individual school districts are. And this kind of supersedes all of the individual school district policies. So that's kind of what this is saying is, you know, from a Florida state legislature, if any school has policies that don't immediately inform the parents of any of these types of concerns with their kids, then they can be sued, and like the teacher can be sued, or the social worker can be sued, or the counselor can be sued. So that's another piece of this, that like if a kid comes out to you as their social worker and they're going through it and they're trying to, you know, they're trying to figure this out. They're working through it before they like have the whole conversation with their parents. You can be sued. Mm-hmm. Your school district can be sued. Mm-hmm. And so like, we should probably be concerned about that.
Yeah.
And again, I don't know what it typically is, but I was like, that sounds aggressive.
Yeah, I think there's like even more implications with that, because if you're talking about any change like to a child's mental, emotional well-being, so if you have a kid who comes to you and they're suicidal and they are terrified to tell their parents, like typically what happens in a school system is that child is reporting to a direct like teacher, counselor, whoever, but you know that that individual is going to be reporting to their superior. And so if there's any type of conflict, because it uses like the reasonably prudent person, like if they would come to this thought that it would be harmful to tell the parent, you know, then don't tell them. But I've seen so many times where a teacher really believes that this kid's at risk, but their administrator doesn't agree. And so they're telling that parent, and then you have a child who's put at risk. I just think there's a lot of potential consequences outside of just the LGBTQ population, like suicide, mental health, like any type of concern about a child in their home. I worry about what that will cause. And I think it also puts like child welfare workers at risk too, because if the school isn't telling the parent and then the parent sues, it's going to be quite easy to bring that child protection worker into that lawsuit as well. As far as like, oh, they came to the school and interviewed without my permission, and this is how it all started. So I think there's just a really big liability issue, and I worry about how this will play out for kids.
And it also specifies that by June 30th or something, that all counseling frameworks have to be re-examined by the Department of Education. That's literally what it says. So like there's the obvious part that is very concerning, and the protected class piece, but also there is this other big piece for mental health professionals who are typically in schools. You know, that's a big issue. And also like, if you, you know, and again, just looking at kiddos, there's just new research published just like in the past like week or two that in the past year, LGBTQ youth, identifying youth have almost a 50% suicide attempt rate. Like that's insane. And the thing we're concerned about is not talking about it. Like, we should probably be talking about all these kids who are suicidal and how do we actually serve them?
Well, yeah, I'm sorry, go.
Oh, I was just going to add briefly that I totally would agree with what you said, Sabrina, about being poorly written, because I think that it is poorly written because it's not written with, I don't believe it's written with the children in mind or the families in mind. It's politically motivated thing. And so when that is the case and you're motivated by that as opposed to what's really best developmentally for children and for students, then that's going to show. And you're not going to get the best product for children. You're going to get the best product for politics or whatever side is in control. So I would agree it's poorly written. It's poorly written from a children's perspective, but maybe not so poorly from a political perspective for those people who want things to go a certain way.
Yeah. And so I was going to add that, not only are we seeing an increased rate of the suicidal attempts and ideation, and I can't remember the exact statistic, but it's a very high percentage of children that don't feel like they have support from their family. And if they're not getting support from their family and now they can't talk about it at school, or they try to talk about it at school, and you have counselors and teachers that are concerned that they're going to be sued if they, you know, indulge this conversation, it just, you know, really makes it a lose-lose situation for the children. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I just feel like there's a lot of issues all the way around with the legislation.
And wasn't there a part of it? I'm sorry, Sabrina, wasn't there a part of it that also, maybe this is what you were talking about a few minutes ago, that after a certain amount of time, then a part of it would be assessed by like the governing body or something, which is, I guess, projected to be a conservative, you know, conservative victories will happen. And so those people that win will be the ones at that time who get to relook at it and then kind of more kind of formalize or memorialize a lot of what is in it now? Or am I just talking nonsense? I thought I read or saw or heard something along those lines.
Yeah, there's bodies that are going to have to approve this that have no idea what they're talking about. And like you said, are not actually trained in this. This is always like why I'm such an advocate of social workers not being in traditional social work roles, is so that we can be in the rooms where people are making choices about other human beings, you know, that like actually understand human beings and how they work. Because even so, there's also pretty good research that shows when these bills are even, when this legislation is even being debated in states, let alone when it's actually passed, the suicidality rate of LGBTQ youth also increases. So we have direct correlations between how many LGBTQ youth will access support lines and will report significant mental health issues, including suicidal ideation and suicide attempts, with legislation that passes that is like anti-trans, anti-LGBT. So clearly it's actually not about the kids.
I have a quick question. I've always wondered this, but since we're on the social work show, are we the only field that has the advocacy portion in our code of ethics compared to other mental health professionals?
I feel like psychologists might, but I'm not
they
sure.
They might, but it's not a common theme. Like, obviously, most have, like, the confidentiality and the cultural competence and, you know, self-determination. But, like, social work is very different in that aspect that it is saying you will go out and advocate. And that means you're probably going to get engaged in politics in some degree, because that's what it means to advocate. Because very rarely is any topic not tied to politics nowadays. I mean, there's a very bipartisan push when, you know, things get so polarized. And so psychology might, but I just feel like it's laid out very nicely in the NSAW Code of Ethics. Like, I'm proud that that's in our profession.
Yeah. And I mean, I just want to say, like, I see psychologists and psychiatrists really advocate and use their platforms. And I see some social workers that don't, right? So, but I've always thought it was really interesting just looking at our code of ethics, how unique it is and how specific it is and how that could be a conflict if you're working, your supervisor isn't a social worker and their code of ethics are different, or, you know, they don't really value those things. And so, yeah, I've always wanted to ask that. So thank you for
I'll dork out for a second, but the APA has one of the strongest lobbying firms kind of in just like the medical field, American Psychological Association. They have a huge building right in Washington, D.C. They have a relatively decent sized staff, and they are the ones who convene all of the behavioral health advocacy coalitions. And so they are pretty big players in the advocacy space, more impactful than NASW has historically been, quite frankly.
Interesting.
That's good to know. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, any last discussion on this topic, or have we covered it pretty much? Heather, you have anything you want to kind of tie it up with, or are you good?
I was just kind of curious what everyone's experience has been in their social work programs and how well you feel like you were prepared to work with this population. So I can start from mine. I'm in my program right now. And I am in a Christian university. And so it's very interesting. Some of the assignments and the critiques, I feel like they are not very aligned with all of the standards of the code of ethics and principles. And so it's kind of interesting because I've had some experiences just advocating on some of our assignments of like, you know, this question and like this test question doesn't make sense. Like the options don't make sense. If you truly understood this population, then this test question wouldn't exist or be written differently. So I've had kind of an interesting experience going to a Christian university and kind of their spin on serving this population. So I'm just curious what everybody else's experience has been.
It's been a while since I've been in school now at this point.
I'm too old to remember.
And so I do know that, you know, where a lot of what I at that time was learning was advocacy and you know, but it was more along the lines of racial ethnic groups and kind of positionality within that sphere. But at that time, I don't recall too much in with regards to LGBTQ. And I just another point related to that, that I think because of me trying to think back what my experience was like compared to what you're saying right now, Heather, and what you're doing. And then I look at my organization where I work, and the range of workers is from people that are, you know, 64 years old to people that are, you know, 23, 24 years old. And so just thinking about what that 63-year-old learned in 1979 or whatever versus what this person just coming out of school, it's kind of crazy when you think about the possible variance of the perspectives that they have on the work and advocacy and their role and all those kinds of things. And so it's just another thing to think about.
I went to UH Manoa, which is in Hawaii on an island. And I would say, looking back on it, I don't think my grad school focused on like clinical work, but they put a huge emphasis on like indigenous practices and Native Hawaiian culture and land and learning all about that. So in regards to, I can't remember taking like a specific course or, but it was very much not so much clinical, but focused on the cultural aspect of it, which I think benefited me as I learned the clinical work, because I was able to rule out what was appropriate for certain people and what wasn't. But I don't actually remember taking like a full class or like, I don't remember it being completely integrated into the program, has its own place. But yeah.
We had a lot of conversations. I do remember having a lot of conversations about when your placement or when your personal, if someone's personal ethics did not match with the NASW, then it was probably time to see yourself out. Like we got to that point of like, this is what you are bound to. This is what you're agreeing to. If you cannot, because of your personal belief system, whatever that looks like, then this is not the profession for you. So we had that conversation, and we also, I had a case law class. I don't know if anyone else took case law in their MSW program. And we did a couple in our family case law section. There were probably at least two Supreme Court cases that we were looking at for LGBTQ folks when it came to family law.
Yeah.
I wish mine had a case law class. That sounds interesting.
Yeah, I don't think mine.
It was my favorite. I absolutely loved it. It was a great class. But it was great because it taught you where all of these like policy, like a lot of these family, you know, like when if you're in child family services, like how all of those precedents got set. Mm-hmm. So you understood why you had to do your job the way you had to do your job. So it's actually super, super helpful.
Okay, well, I think we have a few minutes, and at least one of our co-hosts may need to leave in the middle of this, but that's okay. I think we'll briefly go over our last topic because we've had such great conversations about these other two. We might have a little limited time on this, but if you've been anywhere on social media or watching the news or anything in the past few weeks, you may have seen a little thing that was an altercation of sorts at an award show. Specifically, you know, there was something that went with Will Smith and Chris Rock, that little incident that happened. And so obviously that was big news everywhere from a number of different places and for different reasons. And it's been a very big topic just nationally, probably globally, I would imagine in some respects. But I kind of just wanted to throw out there, not the incident per se, because that, you know, that's a personal thing between those two individuals or those families, and there's other aspects to it. But what I wanted to talk about my view on things was that, you know, Will Smith or when a person is in a stressful situation, whether you're, you know, in this situation, he was going to, you know, go win an award, and he heard some comments that he didn't like, and whatever, he may be going through other things in his life. And so the question being not specific to him, but when we are in stressful situations or, you know, high pressure situations, how is it that social workers either deal with that on our own? Maybe you've never gone to court for a case, for a child welfare case, and your first time in court, and, you know, how do you deal with that pressure? Or, you know, if we're talking with individuals and families and all the pressures that they're under from sheltering in place and job losses and stuff, just the overall topic of dealing with stress or anger or impulse, is any thoughts on that? Again, not necessarily as it directly relates to the incident that occurred, but more just the general topic about some of those areas.
And yeah, so I can weigh in on this. I think, you know, coming from the CPS background, you talked about, you know, testifying in court, and that is very stress inducing, no matter how long or how often you've had to testify. It's always a stressful situation. But I think the most important thing to remember as a social worker is, you know, the image of a duck, right? You're calm and peaceful on the surface, and then you're paddling like heck under the water that no one can see. And so I think that as long as you remain focused and like, you know, presenting the calm, even though you've got everything else, you know, on the inside, I think that also applies to working with very upset or elevated clients. I mean, I saw that all of the time. And I see it now in my internship where, because I work with a lot of kids that have been through traumatic events. And so their regulatory system is off. And so being the calm in that moment, I think you really have to find, you know, your way and how to become that calm and serene, even if you are feeling differently on the inside. So I think that's probably the most important skill for social workers.
I think that's an interesting point that you bring up, Heather, about just the kind of the you know, for children or people who have gone through traumatic incidents in life, and especially at an early age, their brains get wired, you know, as a result or in response to these traumatic events. And so then having to deal with things in life, their brain is wired to deal with it a certain way, as opposed to, you know, something that may be more beneficial to them in the long run or more healthy. And I think the perspective that I was just going to say is that I've been in the field for 25 years, give or take now. And I really don't, I mean, obviously things go up and down, but I don't know if I've seen a time where the people that we work with are under so much pressure, whether it's economic or societal or political or whatever it is. Like, it just seems like the weight on the people that come into my organization, to my office, it feels much heavier than what it did 10, 15, 20 years ago. Obviously for individuals, you know, that goes out the window, but as a general You know, in general, I feel like those that we work with are under that much more pressure. And so I think it's for that reason, it's more important for us even more than ever to kind of be aware and conscious of how people are presenting to us and what do we need to consider in terms of kind of where they're at as far as how we will then interact with them and treat them or work with them. So I don't know if anyone else, does anyone else feel like people are just under so much more pressure now, or is that my little world only?
No, I would agree with that. I think in the child protection realm, I mean, with the pandemic, I mean, we saw families whose financial systems, support systems, completely fractured. And so we just saw an influx of domestic violence and egregious injuries because everybody's stress level was through the roof and they didn't know how to cope with it. And so I think, you know, like what Heather said, like, modeling that calmness in your approach with people. I mean, that's a skill that you're teaching just through modeling, but really just going back to those core, like therapeutic coping and relaxation skills. Like we have to be able to practice those ourselves, but also to pass along that education because not all knowledge is shared, even though it seems so simple, like, okay, take a deep breath, practice, you know, progressive muscle relaxation. Not everybody knows to do that. And when your mind's in crisis and you're escalated and maybe you're just really pissed off, it's not easy to get back to that moment. So I think just modeling that behavior for your clients and having those gentle reminders and teaching those skills. But no, I think the world has been extremely crazy and everybody's under a lot of pressure. So that resonated with me anyway. I don't know. I can't speak for everybody else, but
well, I'm glad I'm not alone. At least there's one other person that's feeling it.
I feel like, okay, so when I think about, you know, the incident that happened, I just finished reading Will Smith's book like 2 months ago. And one of the things that he talks about throughout the book is this core belief that he's a coward. And so taking aside, like just looking at it from a therapeutic perspective, I think that, you know, trauma is not just what happens to us. It is the story. It is the narrative that we tell ourselves about what happened to us. And so with that said, I think from both when we're under stress and we are triggered and our body's responding, it's connected to a story. It's connected to a narrative that's connected to a past trauma or something that happened to us. And so I think for me, it's not just going over those coping skills and modeling them. I think that those are really key, but it's also teaching them how to feel their feelings and feeling those feelings with them, right? So we're social workers, but we're also human. And so I think that when we show emotion in sessions or in that space, it's powerful because it kind of makes them feel like they're not alone. Mm-hmm. But I do think like what happened can go so much deeper than for both of them, you know, and Charlamagne the God on the Breakfast Club in New York talked about this, you know, that core belief that I'm a coward, right? I'm seeing my mom, you know, I'm seeing domestic violence in my home. I can't stand up for my mom. I'm a coward. And then, you know, then, so what happens is throughout your life, if that narrative is triggered 1% by something else, your body's responding. And what we look at in certain treatment models, like, you know, TFCBT or EMDR, is we look at that narrative and we look at, what's connected to it and where, you know, what emotions are brought up and where do you feel those emotions in your body because your body stores it. And so, you know, I think that's what came to mind just from reading his book, but then also being an EMDR trained therapist and looking at trauma from a different lens. That's kind of what stuck out to me or stood out to me.
I think another thing that I'll add to just as a male perspective here is it's kind of sometimes confusing, at least for myself in the world, because, you know, there's there it seemed like there was a lot of people who thought that that actually was appropriate to, you know, to protect your family or to be protective of your partner or whatever. And so the message, there's a big message that as males, you know, we receive, which is that traditional message, be a protector, you know, protect your family, make sure your family is safe, those kinds of messages. But on the flip side of that, we also get the kind of like the toxic masculinity message too, like don't do those things, don't respond like that, don't react like that. And so as a, I mean, obviously whatever gender has their own challenges going throughout their day and through the world, but you know, this for me was one instance when I'm like, okay, well, what is the expectation on me then? Am I a protector of my family, or is that being toxic to do something like that? What, how does the world perceive me as a someone who identifies as a male in this society? So it's something that I'm still thinking about and kind of following along on the periphery, because it's interesting and I want to know, you know, how do I show up to the world and how should I show up?
Well, and I think, I mean, I think that's such a valid perspective. And I think that no matter what a person chooses, you know, on how they want to face something, there's always going to be somebody in society that disagrees with it. And so I think as long as it feels right for you and feels true for you as a person, then you have to go with that. Because, you know, unfortunately, in our society today, people just like to disagree. And so true. No matter what you do, you're going to be wrong to somebody. So you got to be right to yourself, you know, and I think that's the most important thing.
I actually think if no one has anything else to add, I think that's a perfect way to for us to end this week. You know, no matter what people say or do, our jobs are hard enough as social workers, therapists, counselors. You're never going to please everyone. And as long as you're true to yourself, you follow the code of ethics and, you know, you do work that helps people, that impacts people in a positive way, then that's all you can do. And, you know, go to sleep at night comfortable in the fact that you've gone out and done that. So any other closing words from anyone before we call it a night for week two?
I mean, I just want to say, Heather, that was a bar. We need to put that on a shirt somewhere, but I think that was dope.
Yep.
Thank you. I don't know where it came from. I was just speaking from my heart.
All right. Well, that's it for this week, folks. Thank you for watching. We continue to develop and grow our little show here and help people hopefully hear different perspectives from different areas of the field on a number of different topics. Who knows what we'll come up with in 2 weeks. I think we are the second and fourth Friday of every month. 5:30 Pacific time. So join us next time and we'll have another engaging discussion. And if you're watching on YouTube or Facebook, you can put questions and comments in the comment section and we'll be able to see them live. So that's for next time. Thanks everyone for watching. Thank you to my co-host tonight for an awesome discussion and we'll see you next time. So that's it. If you made it this far, thanks for listening to episode 2 of the World's Best Social Work Show. We're already working on the topics for episode 3, and we'll see who the cast of characters is for episode 3. So make sure you subscribe, follow, like, whatever the terminology may be on your platform, so you can be notified when we come out with episode 3. We're just in the beginnings of the show, but we're growing and we have a lot of things in store for you. So thanks for listening and we will catch you on the next one.